I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Two mass shootings in the space of 24 hours in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, have shocked the nation and sent lawmakers scrambling for answers. Some say violent video games and other media are partly to blame. I talked to Stetson University Associate Professor of Psychology Chris Ferguson about why policymakers focus on video games and whether there's a link between virtual violence and real-life violence.
It's really something that comes up only when the shooter or the perpetrator is a young male. So we can look at other, you know, acts that are fairly similar, like the October 2017 shooting by an older male in his 60s, I don't remember his exact age, but who shot up the country music festival in Las Vegas. Or we could look at, like, Amy Bishop, who back in 2010 either shot up her biology department because she didn't get tenure. So when we have older adults or women who commit mass shooting events, people generally don't talk about video games. So nobody kind of points out the Las Vegas shooter as not being a gamer, right? So by doing so, that kind of creates this narrative or perhaps this, like, illusion of a correlation where none really exists. We kind of think, like, you know, every mass shooter seems to be a video game player, but that's only true if we only pay attention to the mass shooters who are video game players and ignore the mass shooters who are not video game players. So it is very selective in the way that this narrative is raised when mass shootings happen. It's only when it's a young male, typically, who perpetrated the shooting.
Is there some piece of research or something which kicked off the idea in the first place that there is or there was a connection between real-life violence and the kind of violence you would see on video games?
I don't know that there's a single study that necessarily kicked this off. I mean, people have been doing research on this going way back to the 1980s, and you know, there never was any kind of conclusive evidence to suggest that video games contributed to violence or society or aggression or much of anything else. There were sometimes where some studies that found effects, sometimes studies that didn't find effects. I think what really happened to the narrative, both in the public perception and in the scholarship, was the 1999 Columbine massacre. I think that kind of solidified the idea for a lot of people that violence, you know, shootings and violent video games had some kind of causal link with each other. And so that's why, particularly in the late 90s and early 2000s, you see a lot of this almost unquestioned narrative about there being some sort of link between violent video games and, you know, mass homicides occurring in society. And you know, unfortunately, the data just even then weren't really there. And as more studies came out in the late 2000s and 2010s, particularly more rigorous studies using better controls, more standardized measures, using pre-registration, you know, a lot of the newer studies just didn't support that narrative. And so we really have a big pool of evidence now to suggest that violent video games do not contribute to societal aggression or violence. And I think that left a lot of people kind of holding the bag. You know, a lot of politicians, a lot of social activists, and maybe even some scholars who would really stake their reputation on this. And it turned out not to be, you know, not to be accurate. And like a lot of things, it's very generational. It tends to be mostly older adults who believe that violent video games are harmful. And for the most part, younger adults are much less likely to believe that violent video games are harmful. And that fits previous moral panics over things like rock music in the 80s and comic books in the 1950s and radio in the 1940s. And you can see this go all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Athens with Greek plays. So there just seems to be something about older adults being suspicious about new technology and media and kind of holding on to those narratives even when the data don't support them.
You've written that the American Psychological Association, they're partly sort of helping to push this idea that there is some link between video games and real-life violence. Could you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, you know, the American – so I'm a member – I'm actually a fellow of the American Psychological Association, just in full disclosure. But, yeah, I think there was an issue, again, like kind of going back into the early 2000s, that, you know, some scholars had really kind of pushed this idea that there was a link between violent video games and you know, aggression at very least, and probably societal violence as well. And you know, so it's important for people to understand that groups like the American Psychological Association are not science organizations. They're not national science bodies. They're professional guilds, so people like myself as a psychologist pay dues to them, and they represent our fields. They market the importance of psychology. So I think back in the mid-2000s, this might have seemed like something like a good bet, that this was an opportunity to show how great psychology was and how to what degree psychology could help people understand, links between violence and media and things like that. And I think, unfortunately, for a group like the APA, the bottom kind of fell out from underneath them. They kind of went out on a limb and made these public statements linking games to aggression, linking games to violence. And then the research turned against them. And the research really more and more said that there are not these kind of links. But it's very embarrassing for an organization like the APA to sort of backtrack and admit that they were, wrong. So even though the APA has come under a lot of criticism, 230 scholars wrote to the APA in 2013 asking them to not release any more of these types of policy statements. The APA's own media psychology division in 2017 released its own independent public policy statement asking politicians and journalists to stop linking video games to mass shootings and other acts of criminal violence. So even though there's been a lot of criticism of the APA's position, they're behaving like a guild. They're defensive, and they're not representing the science that we have today very effectively.
Chris Ferguson, even if the APA were to come out and issue some kind of statement saying, discount the earlier papers that we put out, once it's out there, is it kind of hard to put that genie back in the bottle?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a whole idea in science that we call, I'm going to edit it for radio a little bit, but we call it like the bullcrap asymmetry factor. It's essentially like once bad ideas get out there, it's really difficult to retract them, and get better information out there. And there's all different examples, like, obviously, the anti-vaccine movement, climate science, issues like that, that, once people kind of get it in their heads that something is true, it can be very difficult to persuade them, even with data or information, that their views on things are wrong. So with an issue like violence in video games, the reality is that most people have already made up their mind about this issue, one way or another, either it has an effect or it doesn't have an effect. And what we're seeing in terms of the change over time, we are seeing a change in the narrative. So there's a lot more pushback today to a statement like Trump's than there would have been in the 1990s or the early 2000s. So even over the last 15 years, we've seen a fairly massive change in the social pushback against these types of linkages. And it's not so much, I think, because people have changed their mind. It is more, to put it very bluntly, because old people are dying, and this is a narrative that tends to appeal to older adults. And so what happens is, as an older audience for these types of fears tends to die off, then there's less and less incentive to promote these types of narratives, these types of fears. That's why nobody worries about Ozzy Osbourne anymore, or comic books, or radio, or things like that. But what happens is then just the narrative shifts into whatever the new technology is. So I think probably within 15 to 20 years, we'll probably stop talking about video games. But we might start talking about like virtual reality or whatever, or cell phones or whatever the new technology is. Our technological fears just shift from one new technology to another one, even if we acknowledge that our past fears were mistaken.
I'm wondering too if there might be a bit of a culture shift happening because the audience for video games might be changing. There are people now who are, older who are playing video games and are pretty avid fans of those. So does that have an impact on who it is making pronouncements about whether we should be afraid of these things or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the interesting things that's happened in the last few years is, at least going back to the Parkland shooting from last year, is that this has become a much more partisan issue. So it used to be you would see both Democrats and Republicans push this issue of media violence. Well, in the last few years, it shifted almost entirely to a Republican issue. So we tend to see, like, I think even today, President Trump came up with his statements, and, some of the Democratic Congress people have pushed back against that, saying that he's absolutely wrong on some of these issues. So it's become a much more partisan issue than it has been really in my lifetime, I think, which is sort of fascinating. So I think that, part of this is that it is the generations of people who grew up with like the Atari 2600 and other video games, are now becoming the voting middle-aged adults. And that means that they're going to start to become the audience that politicians have to play to. And as, you know, these, you know, young to middle-aged adults become a bigger proportion of the voting public and are not interested in hearing people blame video games for stuff, I think we're going to see less and less of this narrative about video games being a contributing factor to violence, and more pushback to those individuals who do try to raise it as an issue.
Well, Chris Ferguson, Professor of Psychology at Stetson University, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Still to come on Intersection, Faith Under Fire. We revisit a conversation about faith in the aftermath of trauma. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the aftermath of traumatic events like the shooting over the weekend in El Paso and Dayton, communities often turn to faith leaders for comfort and for answers. We're going to revisit a conversation with Rabbi Steve Engel, Imam Muhammad Musri, and Reverend Brian Fulwider. We recorded this conversation on Intersection last October after a shooter killed 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Rabbi Engel began the conversation.
It was shocking on the one hand, but it wasn't shocking on the other hand, given the vitriolic cultural discussion and the nature of discussion, political and communal discussions that have happened lately.
I want to talk to you, Reverend Fulwider, though, and bring you into this conversation. This isn't the first time there has been an attack on a house of worship. I mean, Sutherland Springs in Texas, the First Baptist Church in November 2017, a lot of people died there. The shooting at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin in 2012. The Dar el-Farouk mosque bombing in Minnesota in 2017, nobody died in that incident, but nevertheless an attack on a house of worship. What do faith leaders tell their congregations when something like this happens?
Yeah, not to mention the attack in Charlotte of the church there. While people were, again, praying, studying scripture, sharing their love and for one another and for the world, I mean, that's what's so, I think, shocking about that. What I think we start with, of course, is shared grief and that sense of our, as the rabbi talked about, our connection with each other. But this connection among every person is such an important part of our message. And then the question, what do we do beyond thoughts and prayers? Because I think we're all kind of tired of hearing that as a trite phrase. It's important if you really are thinking and really praying. That's a wonderful thing. That's not enough. And I think we need to say to all of our communities, it's time to take action. If you feel that elections can make a difference, you ought to make sure you're out to vote and encourage all your neighbors. If you feel that becoming active in some of the organizations that are working for peace, you ought to do that. There are many ways to get active and involved, but we've got to stop this, as the rabbi talked about Tuesday night, this constant cacophony of hate and violence that's coming to us from leaders all over the country. And we're talking not just political, but religious, business, every area where leadership has a responsibility to speak good words and hopeful words.
Imam, we are hearing about how the Islamic community is reaching out in support of the Pittsburgh Jewish community after the shooting, a fundraising effort there for one thing. What's your sense then of what a tragedy like this does to kind of highlight the shared connections between the different faith communities? Is there a sense of solidarity in the face of grief like this?
Absolutely. We feel that an attack on any faith community is an attack on all of us. And as you mentioned in the beginning, there is a history now. Almost every faith community have been touched with violence. And there is apprehension. There is a lot of fear. We believe that, you know, when Muslims were attacked before Jews and Christians came to support our community, and we feel a sense of brotherhood, and we need to be there for each other and to support. And I would say the support here is symbolic. You know, no amount of money is good enough to replace what happened, but it is a message to say we are with you, we support you, we love you, and we are hurting like you are. And that is, we need to stand in solidarity across all faith and no faith, because hate and violence does not have a faith, does not have, you know, they don't care who they are killing, women, children, elderly, you know, 97-year-old, why that person has to go in this violent way. The person who carries out such a crime has no heart. And that is, we need to know that they're not going to discriminate if they were at a mosque, a church, or anywhere else.
I just did want to say, related to what the imam said, that, you know, when people criticize each other's faith and people do this, you know, I was so taken back that the Muslim community in Pittsburgh basically raised the money to pay for the funerals of the Jews in Pittsburgh. That says a lot. It's not about the money. It's about the gesture.
It's, you know, we've kind of gotten to the end of our rope with this this horrible continuing violence in our culture and society. And, you know, sadly, we hear these voices which really highlight violence again. I mean, you know, we're hearing this every day from leadership and talking about, you know, if someone throws a rock, we'll shoot them. This is breeding this kind of anger and hatred, I mean, at every level. And we've got to put a stop to it.
How do you reach then, you know, you mentioned before, it's not just political leaders, it's also faith leaders in
right.
some cases, business
every
leaders.
Leader,
how do you reach those people?
Part of that is helping people learn how to hold others accountable. So there are many ways you can do that. If it's a business leader, you boycott their business. If it's a – who's doing this? If it's a political leader, you vote them out. If it's a religious leader, you get rid of them from your denomination and you begin to talk about how you change the culture. And I think that's what we're about in mm-hmm. this. So wherever people are doing this, we need to hold them accountable and put a stop to it and shift the conversation of our society. It's okay to have disagreements. We should. It makes us better when we sit down and really talk about how we get things done. But to have disagreements to the point that we're inciting violence and death, that's not going to work to build a civil society going forward. And mm-hmm. we're pretty uncivilized in many ways right now.
Imam, what kind of conversations are going on with faith leaders in the Muslim community? I mean, is there more now per just kind of reflecting on what Brian Fullwider is saying, is there more a sense that there needs to be a call to action rather than kind of talking about more sort of lofty ideals of faith? Like, is there are conversations that are happening with, you know, leaders in the faith community and in the Muslim community more about here's what you can do, whether it's getting out and voting, whether it's doing some of the things that Reverend Fullwider was talking about?
Well, in addition to all what Reverend Fullwider just mentioned, you know, we had meetings this week to revisit our security policies and see what else could be done.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked about how to build stronger connections with other faith communities, because this cancer in society is reaching to all parts of society, and both religious and secular. We have seen what happened, you know, at Paul's in Vegas, at Parkland. So it's not restricted, and it is primarily the gun culture, the promotion of, you know, by the NRA. With more shootings, we want more guns on the streets, more guns in schools, more guns. You know, the ridiculous statement that, oh, if there were guns in the synagogue on Saturday, this couldn't have happened. I don't expect...
You mean per, like, having armed security at the synagogue?
Yes, but I have visited many synagogues. I always see security. And, you know, there should not be a security at any place of worship. That should be off limits to guns.
But I think there are probably some faith leaders, at least, who might disagree with that. And I see you nodding there, Rabbi.
But I don't expect, you know, a 97-year-old has to be prepared with a gun to go to the synagogue or to a mosque. You know, we go there to worship, not to – we are not on a battlefield. This is,
sure.
This is America.
But there's a difference between saying to your congregation, you have to come armed, and saying we are going to provide security. And I just want to pick up on that point with you, Rabbi. Do you have some different thoughts on that?
Well, You know, we disagree on the show, and we do it civilly and respectfully related to this, but I think we do have to have security. The problem is that when you have security in a religious institution, it's taking away from programs for kids. It's taking away for – because there's a cost related
sure,
to it.
Yeah.
But the cost of losing life is much higher. And so,
yeah, it's kind of like the debate over security in schools, right?
Exactly. And, you know, and the imam is right. In an ideal world, we would not need to have guns and have people armed. But we've reached a point, unfortunately, that we have to – in our synagogue, we've had for many years armed security guards. And again, I think also what the imam is saying, to not totally disagree with you, imam, is that there's no indication that just because there would have been a security guard that people wouldn't have been killed.
Sure.
That's not a guarantee. All you're doing is narrowing down your odds that someone will be killed during that time. But it is a sad state that we're trying to be – the balance is very difficult between trying to be a religious institution that's open, because you don't want to be like a you don't want to be like a guarded prison. You want to be open, but at the same time, in our religious traditions, the saving a life is primary.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is very difficult kind of situation. And there are congregations where they have people in the congregation that are actually armed, and the religious leader knows. I've gotten calls of people that said, Rabbi, you should get trained and start carrying a firearm. So, you know, these are very difficult times, and the fact that it's even reached this level is just outrageous.
Mm-hmm. My understanding, there were four officers who are trained officers of the law police who were shot. You know, you can't – it's so difficult when you have a permission to carry assault rifles into schools, into, you know, houses of worship. You're going to have these massacres keep happening. Our politicians need to understand that, you know, especially faith leaders mm-hmm. need to understand that the culture of death and killing does not go with the culture of peace and love that we all preach. You know, faith leaders who are concerned about the life of the unborn and they make, you know, a lot of political waves about it, say, what about the already born who have families, who have loved ones, don't they deserve equal rights of protection? And how could you advocate for, you know, carrying arms everywhere and then, you know, at the same time you want to protect the unborn?
So you've got – there's a sort of a bigger philosophical debate going on here. I want to come back, though, if I could, to sort of what's next. And Rabbi, you sort of mentioned some of the things. If I could maybe pick up on that with you, Reverend Fulwider, what does that call to action look like? And if you're talking about – the three wise guys, how you sort of go forward from here, what are you asking from your listeners and I guess from your congregations too?
Well, I think there's a number of ways that it goes forward. So one is we gather in these meetings and begin to discuss what we can do, what tangibly can be done. And I think that's going to be very important because we'll gather a lot of ideas. We have a lot of ideas. We want to share those. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think in terms of what we do, we're going to continue to do the work we do in calling for building bridges, understanding we're all connected. We're all part of the same human family. That is undeniable in terms of biology and other ways. And third, I think as a country, we have to make a decision that we're going to shift our conversation. We're going to shift our way of being in community with each other. And that means we have to stop demonizing the other, whoever they may be. We have to start seeing the other as a fellow human being, a family member on the journey with us.
Even when they do terrible things?
Well, yes, even then. I mean, that certainly is the Christian perspective, that we do embrace everyone, even those who do terrible things. But we call for transformation and change. We call for a change of heart. And we also work hard to stop people from doing terrible things. We all have a decision. Every single day, every single moment, we've got a decision to make. Are we going to, you know, I mean, the old adage, are we going to feed the good wolf or the bad wolf within? Are we going to decide to do the thing that's good? Because I could act that way, all right? I recognize I have the capacity to do terrible things. I make a choice. We all make a choice every day not to do that. We have to call people to make that choice.
Mm-hmm. And Rabbi, you mentioned before that the sort of theme of this message going forward is that words matter. Of course, as a faith leader, your words are very important, right? I mean, that is kind of the core of what you do. But What is more important about this message now? Like, what's changed?
Well, I think from me, my personal perspective is that as a Jew, I'll speak from my faith perspective, is that Jews have been in this country for a long time, and we in the Jewish community maybe lived with a little bit of a myth that anti-Semitism was kind of over and things were getting better. And then all of a sudden, the worst aspect of anti-Semitism, of hatred, of taking a life, all of a sudden, you know, comes to light again. And mm-hmm. so there's like an eye-opening all of a sudden. Oh, my goodness.
And if you listen to the Anti-Defamation League, for example, they say, well, that's actually been on the rise.
Right,
the
increase 37% 2 years ago and 34%, 57% this year. But I think, Matthew, the message is, you know, when three of us get up to give sermons, we carefully pick every single word because we know that as leaders, we are given the ability, just as you are, by the way, in the media, you have a power because you're on the radio wave, airwaves, or the media and television. You are given as a media person, the same as I is given as a rabbi and the president on down to the city council person. Everyone who's a leader is given a power of words. You influence people. It's just how it is. You're given that. And yet we've lost the idea that with that power comes responsibility. And it's sort of like, well, I have the power and it doesn't matter the way I use it. No, it does matter. I, as a clergy person, are counted by every word that I say. You, as a news person, are counted by every word that you say. And I have to say, and I'm not picking on you as a personally, but the media seems to project a lot of negative stories. Hmm. And the more negative stories, but where are the positive stories about the good things that people are doing? Those seem to be a little bit lost.
Rabbi Steve Engel ending that conversation. We also heard from Imam Muhammad Musri and Reverend Brian Fulwider. And that interview first aired on Intersection in October 2018. Up next, can Orlando City keep the dream alive and make it to the playoffs? An update on soccer in the City Beautiful with Orlando Sentinel sports editor Ileana Limon Romero. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Last month, the U.S. women's soccer team won its fourth World Cup title, exhilarating U.S. sports fans along the way. Coming up, we'll talk about the World Cup bump that's carried over into fan following for the National Women's Soccer League, and we'll hear from the captain of the Jamaican women's soccer team, Konya Plummer. But first, an update on Orlando City and their quest for an MLS playoff spot. Ileana Limon Romero is the sports editor with the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Talk to me a little bit about the MLS All-Star game this year. Orlando played host. What kind of response was there? And I'm just wondering if it was sort of a temperature check for the city. Are we still a soccer city? Because there was so much excitement, so much enthusiasm about soccer a couple years ago when we got that major league status.
Yeah, it's always challenging when the wins don't follow immediately. With you jump into a new market, you have a new opportunity, you move up in that level, and you have just this passionate fan support. And to not always have the wins, to go through multiple coaching changes, and to be a little frustrated with the process, that's challenging. But Orlando City seems very much to be on an upswing. They're still in contention to potentially make the playoffs for the first time this year, and they had that momentum going into the MLS All-Star game, which was a huge help.
So talk to me about, you know, what's actually happening with Orlando City soccer. And as far as this coach goes, has he got some stickability? Is he going to be around for some time? And can he help this team grow into what obviously soccer fans and experts, people who are really paying attention to this, would want the team to become?
Absolutely. I think that it is a fair question because Orlando City in its short run has already cycled through two coaches and is on to its third. But there's very much an investment and buy-in from both the players and from the front office that they feel that this particular coach has the team playing up to its potential. Definitely has the attention and support of players within the locker room by all accounts. And thus, the ingredients are there for him to return regardless of whether they make the playoffs this year. There's a lot of confidence and belief in both him and in what the front office is doing, the direction they're going, the course they've charted will carry into next year. So continuity is big. It's a big key to success. We saw that in Orlando with Orlando Magic. They were able to keep some pieces together, and that put them in a great position to be successful, and they made a playoff run, and the hope is that the same is possible for Orlando City.
Right. And I feel like there's something bigger to be said about the identity of the city, right? I mean, the city has kind of staked quite a bit on this notion of the sports corridor with the soccer stadium at one end and the Amway Center at the other, and trying to sort of build up those teams, right? Then having that fan base would help that vision become a reality.
Yeah, I think the fans are definitely there for both. I think everybody loves to see a winner and to get excited by it. It's hard to see losing. It's hard to get excited and keep going out. And to the credit of both Magic and Orlando City fans kept coming out. They never plummeted to the bottom of the leagues in attendance or anything of that nature. They've been there. They've wanted this investment. And what was distinct about Orlando City is a lot of people come from various areas to come to Orlando, or you grew up here, but it's rare to have a cross-section of friends or family members who all support the same team. You have a Knight and you have a Gator. You have a Seminole and you have a Gator. You have various people who cover favorite college teams, different NFL teams, different NBA teams, even though the Magic have been here. But very few people here had a soccer team, a major league soccer team that they'd already identified with. So when one came to their city and one opportunity came here, it really unified and united them. It gave them something that was specifically Orlando that they could connect with very prominently, very clearly, regardless of what their other rooting interests were or where they went to school or where they were from. This was something that could be their city, where they live. And that was a connection that Orlando City ownership tried to foster from the very beginning and did so very successfully.
Do you think James O'Connor, because he played for Orlando back in the day, kind of had some instant goodwill with fans and also maybe playing staff and then the kind of front office as well? I wonder if that gives him a bit of a buffer and will allow him to continue there even if they're not successful in making the playoffs this season.
A little bit of a buffer, but not that much. These fans have expectations. They've been waiting a while. They've been waiting quite a bit to be successful. I think what it did give him was a great understanding of the city, of the club's history, of the passion in the area, and the obligation to connect with these fans and to reward them with, if nothing else, hard work, clear effort, and hopefully some goals that would be entertaining, so that if you attended a loss, at least you saw a team that was giving everything they had every second they were on the field. That is not to say that every other coach didn't do that. I really think that everyone tried, but there are certain things that he's been able to work out because of his understanding of the club and because of his understanding of the players and because of stability in the front office simultaneously that really helped him put him on a path to be successful. So I think it's more his understanding of the city. The fans, they want wins. They're going to be nice and tolerant to a point, but they need to see that buy-in on the field. They need to see the team giving effort every game, and they need to see a certain amount of success in order to feel like it's worth their investment.
In basketball, especially thinking about what's happened with the Orlando Magic, you know, conversations I've had with people who follow the sport really closely are often around, can the Magic get like a marquee player to sort of build their team, the franchise around? Do you get the same sense that that is what Orlando City Soccer needs too? Because there was Kaká for some time. Do they need that superstar, or can they sort of build the team up with the way the players play together, not necessarily any one player being a standout?
They are starting to see the results come together with the existing talent that they have. I think Nani signed on as a player without a ton of buzz when he came in. Certainly didn't match the buzz that Kaká had, but he has been a tremendous signing for the team and has turned into someone who has made his teammates better every day in training and every day in games. And I would argue at times through the run of play has been more successful than Kaká was during his stretch, just because he was been able to avoid injury to date and has been there, has been able to consistently make an impact. And he's someone who really inspires confidence among those he plays with and is helping them play to the highest level. The interesting thing about Orlando City right now is outside of Nani, some of their lowest paid players are some of their top performers. They're doing really, really well. So there's hope that as they make some roster adjustments in the offseason, that they can do this and be successful and highly competitive against the top teams in the league with the collection of talent that's available. They're taking a very comparable approach to the Magic, and they're probably further along. Soccer is interesting in that you can shake up very quickly in the offseason, and there is a chance to jump from the bottom to the top without as much time as it seems to take in the NBA. It is very much tangible and within reach, and I think the investments being made seem reasonable and are starting to pan out, and I think it is still possible that Orlando City make the playoffs this year. So whether you need to blow it up or try to find another big name player to come in and shake things up, of course talent helps. Of course that's going to really sustain you. But the way this team has hung in with the top teams across Major League Soccer, they have confidence in the approach that they're taking right now.
So just from at this point in the season, what does the road to the playoffs look like for Orlando?
Orlando City definitely needs to capitalize on home games, avoid some of the letdowns that they've had. They've struggled to string together back-to-back games at times. They've had great performances and then a bit of a letdown and then great performances. They've also had situations where they've surrendered goals very early in matches, and then that seems to flip the switch for them and they start playing extremely well. It's been very infuriating for their coach. They need to play with a level of consistency and a level of focus during the final stretch. They don't have much room for error, so again, those home matches are very important, and then stealing points on the road is going to be critical. They have confidence, and it will be very interesting to see how this all goes. I think it's easy to call a match against LAFC, the number one team in MLS right now, in Orlando, a big benchmark, a measuring stick, but really it's going to be the collection of the last run of the final 10 or so games that you'll see whether they make it or not. And it's really just going to take really a concerted, focused effort with no letdown in order to get over that line.
It's a few weeks now since the Women's World Cup. Did that sort of inject some new life into fandom for women's soccer in the United States? And is there kind of a knock-on effect for the likes of the Orlando Pride?
Absolutely. I think it's a little bit early. We definitely have seen a World Cup bump. The Orlando Sentinel launched a website, prosoccerusa.com, to cover Major League Soccer, National Women's Soccer, U.S. Soccer, to really aggressively cover the sport in a way we didn't feel was out there quite as much. And we have gotten an amazing response to our Women's World Cup coverage. We sent a reporter, Alicia Delgado, to the World Cup. She filed more than 70 articles from out there just covering and chronicling the team, and they were extraordinarily well received. And then upon return, our Orlando Pride coverage and our U.S. Women's National Team coverage again has really surged. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback on it, a lot of interest, and the Pride had their highest attendance for their first home match with the U.S. Women's National Team players back in the fold in about 2 years. It was a high watermark, and it's been high attendance across the entire National Women's Soccer League. They've seen more sponsorships and more opportunities kick up since the close of the World Cup. And there definitely is a platform. There's an awareness of the sport. And I think they've got some very outspoken leaders on the field who are really pushing the idea that they need to grow that support, that they need to build on it, and that it's going to take investments of fans and of sponsors, financial investments, to make this as good and as strong as it can be.
And is there a crossover between fans of Orlando City and fans of the Pride?
Sure. They have distinct groups. There is some crossover for sure. And I definitely think there's some interest among Orlando City fans who maybe are only casually interested in the Pride, who definitely check in from time to time and certainly would be present if there was a playoff push or if there was a playoff opportunity. But generally, there is a separate group that's loyal to the National Women's Soccer League, to the U.S. Women's National Team players, and to the Orlando Pride. I think we see on the women's side, it is a bit more individualized. Players, fans have their favorite players, and they tend to follow them a lot. So I think there's some star players throughout the entire league who get a ton of attention, and that's very much true here in Orlando. And there's an accessibility that makes it very attractive to families, to kids, to lots of different people, and it can be a slightly different fan base than Orlando City at times. Orlando Pride is on a bit of a break, which is a good timing for them. Orlando City does have a really big match. They're in the semifinals of the U.S. Open Cup. They will be hosting Atlanta United, their rival, for an opportunity to make it to the finals of the U.S. Open Cup. This is a prestigious tournament to be crowned the top team from all levels of soccer in the United States. It's a tournament that's separate from Major League Soccer play. It's an opportunity for Orlando to win its first trophy, a first opportunity to win a championship and to really move forward. There are some benefits that go with it, getting into some other tournament play for later and just really raising and elevating the profile of a soccer franchise. It's important. So Orlando City is doing its best to drum up support. They've reduced ticket prices. They've reduced concession prices. They've urged fans to turn out. This is outside their normal season ticket package. It's not included because they're extra games they earned through play in this tournament, and they're really hoping to have strong fan support. And then also they're a little wary of Atlanta being able to come in and buy some tickets as well, and they certainly don't want to cede home field advantage to a visiting team from a nearby city. But there's high hopes, I think, with Orlando City that they're going to give a spirited, strong performance, and they're really got a lot of attention of their core fans, but are hoping to get just as many people out there as possible.
And so this is just like a do or die one-off match.
Yes, it is a do-or-die one-off match. It will go to penalty kicks to decide it. So there will be extra time. There will be no penalty kicks. I can assure you there will be no draws. It will no ties. This is a pretty big match, and it will be decided Tuesday night. This would be their first ever chance to play for a trophy. So they're two wins away from a trophy, and that is really, really close for a club that has not made the playoffs yet, that has not had a ton of success. You are very, very close. This is the deepest run they've ever had. They were allowed to participate in this tournament when they were at a lower division. And again, this is the strongest run they've had, big performances, and just would mean an awful lot to the franchise and to the fan base if they could pull this off.
Well, Ileana Limon Romero is the sports editor for the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Staying with soccer, we're going to hear from the captain of the Jamaican women's soccer team. Konya Plummer is a senior at UCF. She talked to 90.7's Talia Blake about leading a team that only reformed a couple of years ago.
What was it like bouncing between the life of a college student and a pro player as you were helping the team qualify?
Just balancing any two things is hard, but it's going to worth it, and it did. But from college to my national team, it gets overwhelmed, and I have to learn how to compartmentalize myself and focus on being at Jamaica, or if I'm at UCF, focus on being at UCF and just connecting with the girls differently. And sometimes it was hard and overwhelming, but I rely on God and my coaching.
So this year was your World Cup debut. What was it like being on the biggest stage playing the game you love?
Every time I think about the qualifying moment to just going into the World Cup, I have to smile. I really haven't found words yet to describe my feeling, but it was a life, one in a lifetime, but it's up to us to make more of that opportunity. And it was fun, to be honest, and an experience that I will never get back.
But it won't be your last.
But it won't be my last.
One thing I want to talk about is, you know, 5 years ago, Jamaica didn't even have a national women's team, right?
Yeah.
So how does it make you feel seeing how far you guys went this year?
Not having a women team a couple of years ago to qualify for the World Cup, mm-hmm. has shown that we are capable of doing big things. And the support, Bob Marley's daughter, Sidella Marley, she stepped up and helped us in so many ways. And she have given us the opportunity to go there and express herself on the field. And things like that we need more help to fund camps and just to get younger kids in Jamaica, because, you know, they are the future, and we need to start from a younger age group to have the program running.
The Jamaican Football Federation disbanded the Reggae Girls after they failed to qualify for the 2015 World Cup in Canada. Then after they were resurrected, the federation suspended funding for them again while facing budget shortfalls in 2016. Does it feel like your country doesn't support women soccer players?
All over the world, women's soccer, women sports, or women in general, hasn't been supported as they should, or to our counterparts. But I was on the last national team for Jamaica. I was the youngest, and seeing how they act and the legacy that they have left for me, to actually lead this team right now. It has shown that if the funding did not stop our, if we had the resources, we could have reached further our, just contribute more.
So do you feel like the financial issues the Reggae Girls face is just one of those things that's just holding them back just a little bit?
Definitely. Everything we face holds us back. Even if it doesn't seem that way, it do contribute in we stepping backwards. Because we are soccer players. We should be focused on playing soccer. But if we don't have people in the top, the federation helping, it's difficult for us to focus only on soccer. Because a lot of the girls on the Jamaica team, they work. And leaving their job to come at training camps, and sometimes we don't have enough training camps, but leaving that what they do for a living to come play for Jamaica is because they love it. Because when they look at all that we are getting, it doesn't match up to what they are working for.
And talking about soccer players having to focus on things other than soccer, the U.S. women's soccer team is suing the U.S. Soccer Federation right now. How do you feel knowing women players don't make as much as their male counterparts?
Well, this is a controversial issue, and I would like to see women get more. But to some aspect, U.S. do deserve it, and girls do deserve it, but... for everything that U.S. done, really, as they're more better, well, people classify them better than the male team, and they have won in so many years, and they make women's soccer scene. And for Jamaica, for example, or any other country, women getting equal pay is going to be more difficult because not a lot of people watch women's sports, so it's difficult. But I feel like we don't have to get equal pay. That's what I feel. I don't feel like equal pay, but at least the closeness in the pay gap are things like that.
What do you hope to see for the future of this game?
For the future of this game, I would like to see the change in the pay gap and more countries participating.
And what are your personal goals and plans for the future? Where do you want to take your football career?
Well, at this point, I'm between playing pro and taking my school seriously. And it's not that hard because obviously I'm going to choose football. But injuries and things like that, have you thinking? But hopefully that I'll go play professional in whatever country, because I feel like I have more years in me, to be honest. But I want to give back to Jamaica in a sense also. I don't know if I can be something more, just putting myself out there for the Jamaicans and to inspire younger generation.
Is there any team in specific you would love to play for?
Well, growing up, I always want to play in England. But I'm just sitting here waiting to graduate college to really focus on what's next, because I don't want to think about tomorrow and not focus on today. So that's what I'm doing right now.
And that was Konya Plummer, the captain of the Jamaican women's national football team, the Reggae Girls, talking to 90.7's Talia Blake. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.